Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nicholson Baker, whose latest novel is The Anthologist. There are 7 novels and 4 nonfiction works. We'll be talking about 2 of those a little bit later. One is Double Fold, Libraries and the Assault on Paper, and the other is Human Smoke. But first, let's talk about your new book, The Anthologist, which is a comic novel about poetry. As I was reading it, I kept thinking, I'm not quite sure, is this Nicholson Baker's way of sneaking in a book about the nature of poetry as a novel so people will actually read about poetry, or is it something else?
I guess you could say that it was my sneaky plan, but it's that when I think about things, I like to have them be thought about in a place. Some person is sitting in a chair and something's happening, a bird is chirping, or the person has a Band-Aid on his finger or something. It just seems to me that when you consider big ideas like why do people like rhyme or something like that, or why did rhyme go away in the 20th century and come back? Those kind of questions, they're a little bit misty and hard to hold on to unless you have a person doing something and thinking about a piece of it because his own life pulls it out of him.
Were you thinking about making it maybe a nonfiction
thing? Yeah. When I first started to work on the book, I'm ashamed to say it began with the metrical theories. I was sitting in the yard and I started to chant out bits of poetry and felt that I had a theory. I had a theory of meter. I felt that I had discovered the missing rest, you know, and I got very excited.
Well, why poetry? What drew you to this particular book at this particular time?
I started it before the Iraq War, and wars are very, very distracting. And then I wrote some exceedingly political books. But, you know, if you solve all of the things that are really distressing, you are at the zero point. So what do you look around for? You want, give me some art, give me some joy. Let's have some lines of poetry and some faces painted beautifully. So I thought it was time to go back to the kinds of things that I really like. And also, I have lots of doubts and worries. I'm 52, and what have I done, you know, and what have I contributed? So I've imagined this poet. He's slightly different from me. He's single, his girlfriend's love, but he has the same thing. What have I actually accomplished, and what is left in me, you know?
Well, why is his name Paul Chowder?
I kind of like the name Chowder. It's a mix. I was thinking of corn chowder. Not a clam chowder, a corn chowder. I mean, mixed. Lots of things going on. He's mixed up. He's confused. He's a writer of free verse, which is a kind of a chowdery substance. But he yearns to have the smooth sauce velouté of the French cuisine of 19th century poetry.
Well, you also apparently, though they're not in the book, wrote poems by Paul Chowder?
Oh, gosh, yes, I did have late in the book, writing of the book, which I started to think, okay, he's a poet. And I had a really happy day or two. I wrote something like, I guess I wrote 30 Paul Chowder poems, and I showed them to my wife. And she picked out 2 or 3 that she thought were okay. And I just realized, well, for one thing, I realized that when you read memoirs by poets, the good poets don't quote themselves extensively. So why do that? Also, the poems, when I looked at them, I realized were not Paul Chowder's best work. So I didn't want to inflict them. I wanted it, I guess, to be implied. He's kind of a middle-level person. He isn't the poet laureate. He's never got a Guggenheim. No, he did get a Guggenheim. God bless him. He got a Guggenheim way back when.
One thing I've noticed not merely in novels, but also in film, is that when you see an artist, and then you see the artist's work, and they're acclaimed as a great artist. So we've seen this countless times, rock and roll bands who are supposed to be the Rolling Stones, only they have their own original material. It's never that good. The poetry is never that good. And the sections of the novels are never that good. You know, maybe the exception is if Margaret Atwood writes a poem as somebody because she's Margaret Atwood and she's a poet.
Yes. No, it's true. It's very risky to do it. The way I solved it was I had my hero, Mr. Chowder, writing this draft of a poem. If you write the draft of a poem, and then he says later that he had spruced it up a bit, then I could imply that the final product was a little tighter than the one that we saw on the page.
There are many poets mentioned in the anthologist. Now, I read this novel as the introduction that Paul Chowder is writing to an anthology. Is that the right way to read this?
Yeah, I think that's the right way. He's supposed to write a brief introduction, and it's difficult for him because the anthology that he's supposed to be doing is called Only Rhyme. It's supposed to be only poems that rhyme, and he's going to pick the most incredible, soul-destroyingly beautiful poems, he thinks. How do you introduce something like that? Because you're, in a sense, introducing everything that you can't do. He's standing there in front of the history of English poetry. It's at once paralyzing and also pulls out reams and reams of material. And so the novel itself is the best job that he can do of writing this introduction. And his editor at the end says, yeah, it'll work, but we'll have to make some cuts.
Like all the personal material, I guess, which in a way dries up the book, I guess.
When I go to a poetry reading or so, and the poet stands up and says, I came to write this poem because, and then has a little story. I love those little stories. I want to know how something came to be. Or if, let's say, a great philosopher, if you learn that Kant happened to have had a very strong cup of coffee and then came up with a certain page in his great work, X. That's interesting. In fact, it's more interesting to me than just reading the page. I want the page, but with all the messy life events attached to it, all the wires hanging off it.
Well, you've hit my secret on why I do these interviews.
The person connected to the
work,
the strings
correctly.
Of words.
Yeah. Putting aside the fictional character of Paul Chowder and his neighbors, it appears, though maybe I'm wrong, that everyone mentioned in the book and all of their works are nonfiction, are real. Is that correct?
Almost all. I made up one or two poets who had given Paul a fairly good reviews. But in general, yes, the editors of The New Yorker appear. And I mention well-known poets and less well-known poets because, well, it's fun, for one thing. I mean, it's very exciting to include a moment, a scene with Paul Muldoon, the new poetry editor of The New Yorker, and have my imagined character talking to him in Switzerland. Very heady moment for me as a novelist.
Well, the people that pop up a lot, Sarah Teasdale, mm-hmm. real, Louise Bogan, Elizabeth Bishop, Billy Collins, James Fenton, all real?
Oh, yeah. Teasdale is a little obscure because she was sort of dismissed as a jingler, you know, as someone who wrote light verse that could be recited at ladies' clubs. But she's actually has a wonderful ear. And I think that she's closer to the soul of poetry and to the real sounds of the 20th century than her nemesis, who's Ezra Pound. They didn't like each other. Ezra Pound sneered at Sarah Teasdale, and Sarah Teasdale didn't have much time for Ezra Pound. And I think she was right.
Nicholson Baker, one aspect of the anthologist, because I don't read poetry and I don't go to poetry readings. I went to a poetry slam, and I loved it, but I never went back. But you make a point, and I think one of the problems in dealing with poetry, and it probably has to do with what you talked about, which is the triumph of free verse, is that all music lyrics are poetry, and certainly rap is poetry. So you can mention Ludacris, you could mention Lennon McCartney, you could mention Stephen Sondheim, you could mention Ira Gershwin. Mm-hmm. They're all famous poets.
Exactly. And in 300 years, what we probably will say when we look back at the 20th century is not, oh, that was a century that free verse triumphed. What we'll say is that was the most rhymingest, metrically packed, richest, juiciest, traditional versedness century ever because of those people like Dorothy Field and Gershwin and Cole Porter and all that. They did such a job, clever, beautiful, internal, external rhyme, that in a sense what people called real poetry had to adjust. It had to find a different way. So it was pushed off into a corner, and it had to be different, and it became different by becoming aggressively free. At least that's one explanation for what happened.
In other words, those big books that I have, the lyrics of Ira Gershwin and the lyrics of Cole Porter, that's really my poetry collection.
Oh, certainly. Part of your, you've got to say it's part of your poetry collection. And it's funny. You know, why can't poems be funny? Of course they can be. And another thing that was really good about the 20th century is there was lots and lots of good light verse. And that tradition is only just glimmering now. It's not really there anymore. The New Yorker magazine used to publish a lot of light verse, and it was good.
When we're looking at a book like The Anthologist, and we're looking at modern poetry, how easy is it, you think, for people who like rap or Green Day, anything, to get back into reading poetry? I mean, I tried. I interviewed Mark Doty once, and he said the best way to read poetry is to read it aloud over and over and over again, and suddenly you get the rhythm.
Yeah, and he's a very nice guy, and he's a good poet. So I think that's good advice. The free verse that I like W.S. Merwin, is really interesting because it's sometimes a puzzle. With Merwin, there's no punctuation. You don't know where phrases begin and end. So part of the fun is that you lie in bed holding the book horizontal, and you start reading it, and you don't actually know where to stop. Then you hear the meaning units, and the thing starts to pull apart a little bit. It becomes beautiful in a strange way because you've puzzled it out. Sometimes free verse doesn't present that. With, say, Mary Oliver, what you do is read the poem and you go, oh, my God, that's a beautiful image. I mean, you've just compared a dead snake to a bicycle tire. It's incredible. Or you've just told a little story about being in a restroom in the Far East and somebody has been cleaning out an ashtray in the toilet. It's a beautiful, tiny moment. So I think the way to read poetry is just to read around it until you find something that actually makes you go, gosh, I'm going to remember that, and then read it again.
And I think it was in the New York Times, you compared poets to crossword puzzle makers or crossword puzzle doers, and in the sense that it's all about puzzling things out. And I know, for instance, Stephen Sondheim is an inveterate puzzler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, W.H. Auden, who's one of the huge poets of the 20th century, big drinker, wore bedroom slippers, you know, kind of a shambling guy, but brilliant, compulsive crossword puzzle doer, and a depressive. There's this complete correspondence. Depression requires distraction. Puzzles are very distracting. And what if you decide, okay, a crossword puzzle's fine, but all you get is the reward of finding that something goes across and something goes down. If you posit a rhyme word, an ending word that has a certain sound, and then you say, I have to write something piercingly beautiful that has the similar sound at the end, that's a richer kind of puzzle, because you're actually trying to do something that makes people want to sing it, read it again and again. Not just solve the puzzle, but live with this string of words. I think that that's why it's sort of the ultimate puzzle. And puzzle is too small a word, but I mean puzzle in the richest sense.
You know, Oscar Hammerstein may be underrated because he wrote character rather than clever. In South Pacific, couldn't come up with a rhyme and used bromidic, a word that would never have been used by Nellie Forbush from Kansas, and something like that just sticks out. I mean, it's like a puzzle didn't work.
Yeah, bromidic. What does it mean?
It means happy.
Bromidic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's great when part of the things that happen is when you have to, I'm not the first to say this by any means, of course, but when you have to make things fit a certain pattern, you actually kind of crunch the language a little bit in a way, because it's then memorable. You enrich the language. So everybody then says, the lone and level sands stretch far away. And he wouldn't have said the lone and level sands because it's not quite the way to use it, but it has to fit the meter. So he does. And now we all think of it as Ozymandias by Shelley.
So I'd like to talk about a couple of your nonfiction works.
Mm-hmm.
Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II and the End of Civilization. Apparently, it came out of newspapers, working with a lot of old newspapers, which is part of something called the American Newspaper Repository, which
right.
you began in 1999.
I was writing a book that was essentially trying to make the point that it's fine to take pictures of things. In this case, it was microfilm. But if you take a lot of pictures, that doesn't mean you want to replace the thing itself. In this case, these big, beautiful newspapers edited by Joseph Pulitzer or Hearst or the New York Herald Tribune. You don't want to replace those big, very fancy, sometimes colorful things with these scrolls of plastic. So that was the point of that book, of Double Fold. In the midst of doing that, I found out that there was a large collection of newspapers that were being discarded, auctioned off by the British Library. So we raised some money. I put some of our own money into it, and we bought this collection and brought it to a mill building in Rollinsford, New Hampshire. And it was a revelation to me because, I mean, you just crack open. You don't even crack open. You carefully open these big things that look like huge atlases that are filled with the New York Herald Tribune, 1939, and the coverage of the World's Fair, and the already disturbing, terrifying events in Germany. But it's all covered there with a kind of, I don't know, vividness, and it's all anchored to particular dates. So it changed the way I thought about history because I was just, I guess I was sitting amongst 20 tons of newspapers. That was one beginning for the book Human Smoke.
When it began to come together, how did it come together so that you would write essentially anecdotes from newspapers mostly? I mean, there's a couple of things. Klemperer's material is from his books.
Yeah.
All of these anecdotes which present this view of the world from about 1932, I think it is, up until the end of 1941.
Well, partly because I don't understand the period. I still don't understand it. I don't presume to be a historian, but I knew from having looked in these volumes that there were surprises, that there were things that didn't make sense.
What was the biggest surprise then?
The crucial surprise, the thing that I think is most important in the book, is the close conjunction between the people who were most concerned about saving Jews in Germany and pacifism. The pacifists were the most articulate and steadiest exponents of the idea that we had to relax immigration quotas and do something. And the pacifists were actually the people who saved more Jews from the place where they were most at risk than any other group. And this, to me, I think is a powerful discovery because they were right in saying that. Obviously, when England declared war on Germany, what's the first thing that happens is that all the borders go clanking down. There is no way that any Jew can get into England after that point. Wars close borders. I'll tell you one real surprise, too, was, and this was after I donated the whole newspaper collection to Duke University, which is where it is now. So I was working from ProQuest, from digital copies. And there's nothing wrong with a digital copy, but it just isn't quite as easy to do research on. But looking through the front pages of the New York Times, and it says, Woods are bombed. And it was the coverage of the attempt by the Royal Air Force to set fire to the Black Forest. And you have to ask yourself, you have to imagine this group of men in a big table in London, Churchill, etc., and they think that the way to inhibit this unprecedented menace was to set fire to the Black Forest. And several times, you know, and other forests, the Harz. There's an insanity in the beginnings of this war. There's a chaos. There's a bestiality that comes from all sides. And in order to feel it, you have to look at it as individual particles and see how they contradict and how they kind of crush against each other.
At what point did you realize that there was a book there?
There's another part to the story. I wanted to tell the story of the Library of Congress during the war because they had a lot of intelligence analysts were working at the Library of Congress. And then you have to ask, well, if the Library of Congress's activity is being directed in this other direction towards war work and away from the safekeeping of objects, is that a good or bad thing? Well, it depends on whether the war itself is the right thing to do in reaction to Germany. I realized there was a book when I realized that I didn't know the answer to that and that I had to write that book, the book about the beginnings of the war first before I could write about this case study of in library history.
Are you going to write that book?
I'm going to write about that. I think it's not a whole book. So many horrible things happened in the Second World War, and I know more now. And I just don't want to tell that as a whole book. The difficulty, if you're writing something like the book that I wrote, which is so much is going on, you're always leaving things out. I just gave up on worrying about that. I would find something, and I would think, this is less known, or this, I can't forget this. There's a juxtaposition here, and so I would put it down. But I wouldn't worry so much about the fact that, because I left all these blank spaces, it's a piece of time, blank space, piece of time, blank space. And it's just an attempt to add enriching confusion, because I think that there is a sort of received idea about this war, that it was just to fight it exactly the way we fought it. And unless you crack open the enamel around that idea and look at what the decisions that actually happened, you're never going to really get at the answer to the question of whether it was a just war, whether there should be these special brackets around it. All other wars, questionable, not right. But this one, we had to fight it exactly the way we fought it because of these terrible things. What if there were moments where millions of people could have been saved early in the war, as the pacifists were saying, with the United States and England as their advocates at the negotiating table? They had more of a chance than in the battlefields of Europe.
There were several moments in the book where I stopped, and one of them I want to talk about in a minute, which is the book's relationship to 2008, 2009, and Iraq War, because, of course, that kept creeping in. But Churchill, and this comes from newspapers, was quite mad. He was a nutcase.
You have to say it. I mean, I'm glad you said it, because I think it's absolutely, unquestionably true. He's also a genius. He has a tremendous facility with words. Because he's such a moody man, a manic depressive, he painted and had times in his life where he was had a very quiet literary life. But during the war, he was on a manic high, and he wanted people to die. And he was frighteningly casual about casualties even in his own country. I mean, it seems very clear from what he said that he wanted England to suffer repeated and really quite horrendous bombings in order to bring America in the war. And he was a man who fantasized about a titanic struggle between great powers that would continue the First World War, where he also had been very much in charge. And he got to write the history then of both wars. He fights both wars, and then he writes the histories of both wars. I mean, talk about power.
One of the other revelations was, and I don't know where you found it, but it's astonishing. I guess I could look it up in the index. Is that had Chamberlain not gone to Munich and given away Czechoslovakia, Hitler would probably have tried to invade. The German people didn't want a war, and the generals were ready to throw him out at that moment. But when Chamberlain suddenly showed up and gave Sudetenland, that killed the coup.
Well, that's certainly what the general said afterwards, and that is, I think, a fair assessment. Although those generals are so horribly weak-willed, and so they're will of the wisp. I mean, when Hitler has a good day and managed to barrel into some place, they love him. And then when he seems a little bit crazy, which he obviously was shouting and screaming and all that, they would have their doubts. I don't know if there's any one single moment that is an absolute kind of a two roads diverged moment, but certainly that's a critical one.
That all of these Jews escaped from Germany, came to Britain, and then were locked up in detention camps.
I was really shocked by the fact that here are soldiers with fixed bayonets escorting these 70, 80-year-old Jewish refugees. It reached a peak just after Churchill came to power, and we really have to kind of confront this, that the first, I think it's the very first cabinet meeting that Churchill had. What did he want to do? Well, there were two primary things. One was to attack the German heartland with airplanes, okay, which they'd not avoided doing that under Chamberlain. And the second was a very large roundup of aliens and suspect persons. 85% of those were Jews. So there was an enormous incarceration, and many Jews spent the entire war in prison, and some of them were sent to Canada. Some of them were released to do war work, but the vast majority just were held because they had escaped, and now they were foreigners, and therefore they had to go to jail.
For me, when I was finished reading Human Smoke, what came up is we're an absolutely insane race.
I think that if you look at this period of the Second World War, it has to be the most hideous five-year stretch in history, so it's going to seem crazy. But if you ask yourself whether this human project is in general, I mean, if you fly over humanity as a bird and you swoop down, you're going to come to a village somewhere where basically people are doing reasonably nice things with each other. There are these paroxysms. That's why we call them wars. And then all the rules go away. And the key, which is one of the things that the pacifists really recognized, is that as soon as you start the definition, you say, okay, we're now in a war, and then you have it be a long war, then the extremes of human behavior, all the saber rattlers and the crazies and the screamers take charge. And the longer the war goes on, the crazier everybody becomes.
At the same time, you know, I'm reading about Gandhi saying, well, all we have to do is stand up and do nothing. And Hitler's going, fine, I'll just gun you guys down. I don't care.
Gandhi is one of the, you know, principal characters of this. And I was fascinated by his reaction at every point to the developments of the war. And some of what he says is, I think, is true. When he says Hitler is a man with a normal span of life, he is going to die. So don't think of him as some kind of immortal, endless, powerful source of evil. You know, he had a tremor. He wouldn't have lived forever. So that's, I think, a useful perception. When he says something like, we will cheerfully submit to slaughter, there's a coldness that comes from his having resisted the British Empire for decades. And with Churchill at the lead, said, no, we own this country, we are going to control it. And not only that, but we're going to put 50,000 more of you in jail. So he's been resisting this empire for decades. And he does sound remarkably cold. But the other thing to point out about that is what Churchill says is oddly similar. I mean, the funny thing is, Churchill says, we're going to fight them on the beaches, and we're going to fight them, and they're going to kill our beloved citizens, and they'll take our land, but we will resist to the last Britisher. You know, that's basically his idea. We will all die rather than submit to Hitler. Gandhi says, we will all die and submit to Hitler. What do you really want to have happen? You really want to have the most number of people survive, physically and mentally survive, in places where they're at risk. I think that the great thing about the pacifists is they kept their eye on that fact. They always were thinking, who is at risk? Who's at the bottom of the hierarchy? And that's why Hoover and that whole effort to get food to the Polish ghettos was so important. They were getting food to Poland from the United States until Churchill said, no, we're going to shut off the Navicerts, and you're not going to be able to get food there. There is something to be said, and we know it now from 9/11, is that when things drop on your head, you get really irrational and angry. We had a firebombing of two buildings, and immediately there was a wave of militarism that just swept through the country. Foreigners were locked up. New institutions of oppression were created, all that stuff. Is it really the best way to resist the horrific racist bigotry and the state-supported anti-Semitism of Germany? Is the best way to do that to attack buildings and national symbols? Wasn't the bombing of Germany, in fact, a gift to Hitler? Didn't it actually consolidate his power? That's what Shlomo Aronson, who is, I thought, an interesting historian, one of the few I quoted in the book, said the bombing of Germany increased and made worse the atrocities against the surviving Jews. That is a terrifying fact, because it went on for years.
Well, I look at Dick Cheney wanting to bomb Iran, And I see the same situation that now Iran is going through what it's going through. But what had happened if the U.S. had bombed Iran?
It can't be good. It is never good. You cannot bomb a country into being civil. It will never work. It has never worked. But the British Empire decided it was going to work because they had been using this bombing technique on tribesmen and small villages all over the world in the 20s and 30s. This was the way the British Empire tried to save money, which was by air control. And because they had used it in a small way in Africa and in the Middle East, they thought, we'll try this in Germany. And the results were not good.
Nicholson Baker, what do you think of Google's book project?
I love Google Books. I mean, I'll say that first. I have learned many things I wouldn't have known by using the fact that they have scanned all these books. I don't think that it's such a good thing for one company to control the digital rights to an entire century. I mean, that's a frightening amassing of authority in one corporation. I don't even think that Google meant it to happen. It's a strange result of the settlement. So I like Google Books as a scholar. I think it's helpful when you find something in an electronic database, any kind, Google Books or others, and then you go to the library and get the original book, and then you fit it that in with a newspaper. You can find things and make connections that you couldn't make. Triangulate. You can triangulate.
10 years later, after Double Fold and your railing against the death of card catalogs, what's your view of it now?
I think that the basic point that I was trying to make with the card catalog piece is still pretty much valid, which is that if you have these big wooden databases, machines that have been created and groomed and thought over by librarians for generations, and they contain a snapshot of what was available to a community of readers at one time, they're historical objects. When we want to find out what people were able to read in a certain medieval cathedral town, we look at the book catalogs. We know that in such and such a year, they had this copy of Cicero, or didn't. In this case, there were these big, bulky, heavy things that could have just have gone down in the basement. The fact that electronic catalogs do all kinds of nifty things, but they also have very poor memories. What happened with the San Francisco Public Library, when I got exercised about that, they got rid of a lot of books when they were moving to a new building. And it was almost impossible to know what was gone, because the books were just discarded, and then the electronic files were just groomed so that those records didn't exist. And there's no tagging. There's no saying, this book was part of the collection and now isn't. So you have no history of what was there. And knowing what was part of a culture is important to doing history.
Your recent article on the Kindle in The New Yorker starts out very negatively and finishes up by your going, well, you know, I just finished my Kindle book. My own view is that people think it's either or, that there are either books or electronic reading. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that, no, it's not the same as a CD and downloading music. It's not the same as that. It's different, because books are different from a CD or a record.
Right. We want to read books. We have different reasons. If you travel a lot, an electronic reader is very convenient. And some people just like machines. I think there are many people who've said, I've started reading again because I've bought this machine, and they're excited by it. I wanted to like it more than I did, because I think it isn't a particularly elegant machine. I mean, I like machines a lot. What I found was that the Kindle, which was kind of a gray screen with gray type on it, was a nifty invention, these balls going up and down in colored dye with electrical currents, but it was a prototype. I found in the end that if I'm going to read an electronic book, which I want to do sometimes in the middle of the night, I want to read it on an iPod Touch. I mean, I found that I actually like this little one-man show of software called Eucalyptus. You spend $9.95, you get 20,000 books. They're beautifully formatted, and when you turn the page actually kind of, it has its own page physics, and it has a shadow, and it undulates, and it's fun. It's a new way. It's exciting. So I've been reading Edgar Allan Poe in the middle of the night, his stories, Descent into the Maelstrom, you know those ones, on this little machine that's about as wide as a New Yorker column, having a great time. And during the day, you know, I read books with ink on paper, or I look up things on the computer. But it's, you know, exactly what you're saying. All these things layer on top of each other. It's not a replacement program. It's different kinds of ways of reading do different things well.
I get the feeling that if everything went electronic, maybe I'm wrong, so let's say in 30, 40, 50 years, then 2,000 years from now, from the point where everything went electronic, nobody would know anything because mm-hmm. it would all be gone.
When you make this argument that Kindle and reading newspapers online is a green thing, you have to add in the time element, because books just sit around and they don't draw current and they don't need server farms and really any recharging once they're printed. So the longer it is that you take to read a book, in my case, I like to have books around for decades because I sometimes dip in. Well, then I'm saving energy. So it's in some ways, it really depends on your reading habits, whether even it's environmentally responsible to have print on paper.
And, of course, without books, there's no trophy wall of the books you've read.
Yeah, the trophy wall is a good thing, but it's also just these are your friends, and they're battered, and you remember when you, by mistake, sat on that book and crushed the cover a little bit, and that's part of it. It shows its redness. I love used books that are marked up by other students and stuff, the little happy faces and the stars in the margin, because I think, well, that's already traveled through somebody's mind, and now I have it.
I was thinking when I was reading your article that when I first read Lord of the Rings in 1965, you know, I was in high school, and I'd found it on the bookcase. It was the unauthorized version that Don Walheim stole from England, you know, the Ace copies. And later on, I read it in the, you know, authorized version, and it was never the same. I wanted those blue, red, and mustard copies because that was the Lord of the Rings to me. There was something more than just the book.
Well, see, I didn't know that whole story, but I was always fascinated. I read it in the paperbacks that were authorized. There was something in the back. It was a little box that said, this is the true and authorized edition of my books. And then it was signed with J.R.R. Tolkien's very beautiful, fancy, Middle-earthy signature.
Well, that's the story.
That's the story. So I read it I had a completely transforming experience reading the authorized version. You read the unauthorized version. And we both have book memories that are so attached to the physical paperbacks that we held, all those thousands of pages.
Nicholson Baker, it seems pretty obvious that you work on several projects at once. What have you got going now? You mentioned this Library of Congress book, and have you started work on another novel?
I've got some fiction things simmering. I want to write some more nonfiction pieces, partly because writing novels is a little bit solitary and introspective. And if you tell a magazine that, well, I'd like to write about the Kindle, then you get to call people up and interview them and learn things, and it's fun to learn things. So I wrote a piece last year about Wikipedia for the New York Review of Books because that seemed worth thinking about. And so there are other nonfiction, shorter pieces that I'd like to write and maybe collect those into a book.
Can I make a suggestion? Put it in the back of your head. Human Smoke ends on January 1st, 1942. And I love the way you put the book together. I would love to see January 1st, 1942 to, I don't know, the start of the Korean War.
You're the first person who said that. I want to do that. I want to do that very much because I feel that there's much more to, obviously, to the war. And I think that my wife and my publisher, and they all say, no, no, no more war. We need to escape. It's too horrible. And that's valid, too. So I appreciate that suggestion, and I'm going to bring up what you said when I talked to them.
You've been listening to an interview with Nicholson Baker, whose latest novel is The Anthologist. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.